Hello and welcome to the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. The Oregon Wine History Archive is located at Linfield University in McMinnville, Oregon, and is dedicated to preserving and sharing the Oregon wine story. This podcast shares these stories through oral history interviews we've conducted throughout the industry. Please enjoy today's episode.
My name is Rich Schmidt. We're here with Ollie Howard. It's February 12th, 2024, with the Nicholson Library at Linfield University in McMinnville. Ollie, thank you so much for joining us today. And the first question, we usually start with why wine, but why don't you tell us a bit about your background first. Tell us about where you're born and raised and kind of your early childhood life.
My name is Aldous Newton Howard. I was born in Clinton, Massachusetts, March 24th, 1939. My father was a book printer. He worked for in Clinton, Massachusetts, and my mother taught kindergarten. I have two brothers, both younger, and then. I went through the grade school in South Lancaster, Massachusetts on, Narrow Lane School for the eighth grade. Then I did 1 year at high school, and then I went to Mount Hermon School for Boys in Gill, Massachusetts. My grandfather had taught at Mount Hermon. My father had gone to Mount Hermon at D.L. Moody Institutions. And he built Mount Hermon and then built Northfield School for Girls on the across the river, Connecticut River. So I was destined to go to Mount Hermon, and I went. And I met a whole bunch of people, and I got a good education, but I didn't graduate. And my parents were a little disappointed, particularly my father. So they sent me from Boston, Massachusetts to Portland, Oregon to live with my mother's youngest sister, the best thing they ever did. I went to Beaverton High School, graduated from Beaverton High School, and went down to Crater Lake National Park as a fire guard for 2 summers. And I was accepted at Pacific University. I was accepted here at Linfield. Anyway, I went to Pacific 2 years. And then I went to Antioch College in Ohio because one of my neighbors that I babysit the kids for was an Antioch graduate. And he decided that with my background and my education and the way I took care of his kids, that I was going to go to Antioch. Well, I went. That was a royal mistake. I just remember one thing, that I had to take physical education, and I ended up playing varsity lacrosse with the girls' team. They tried to kill me, but I was the only guy on the team. Anyway, I got out of Antioch, went back home, and spent a few months at home, and then I realized that I was next on the draft list. So I went back to Portland and enlisted the United States Navy. 6 years, five years in Scotland, Holy Loch, Scotland. I had a child with a lady that I met in Scotland who abandoned us when my son was 2 years old. And I was the only person, a man, allowed to have custody of a child and allowed to immigrate out of Great Britain in the history of the country. I got a solicitor, a lawyer, and we went down to London and got everything straightened out, and they rewrote the law. And I was able to get back into the country. And I remember going through immigration in Boston. I had a check, papers like this, and the old man with a hat on came up and he looked at me and looked at my son. And he said, "Welcome to America." He took a big stamp, boom. So Mac was then stayed with my mother and father for a couple of years. I went to get out of the Navy early. I had to get accepted at a university. So I was accepted at the University of Denver in Colorado. And as I mentioned earlier, my mother taught kindergarten. And there was a lady named Carol Christie. I went skiing with her and broke my leg. on Loveland in Loveland Basin. And right up the canyon, there was another avalanche. And everybody left but the doctor. And here I am with a bunch of people in this, all busted up. And the doctor says to me, he said, can you hobble over here? I said, yes, I can. So I hobbled over. He said, hold this guy down. I'm going to turn his foot the other way. So I grabbed this guy right across the chest and held him down. And Doc turned his foot around. And I had a spiral break in my leg, which was okay. You know, it wasn't too bad. And I went to the hospital in Denver and recuperated. I broke three casts. One was dancing. I fell off the stage with this lady. And then I broke one going downstairs and another one, I can't remember. But anyway, the doctor told me, one more break in this cast and I'm going to lock your ass up in hospital and you won't get out till it's well. So I got better. And then I went to work for Western Electric Telephone Company. It was AT&T Telephone, but Western Electric as an installer. And I did that. I was, you know, my leg was okay, but it wasn't the best. So I did that for about a year and saved my money. And then I called Charles Trombley at Pacific University in Forest Grove, and he wanted to know where I was. And I told him I was in Denver, Colorado, and he said, well, we're going to start classes here Thursday. This was a Monday or something. He said, if you can be here, you can go back to school. So I jumped on a Greyhound bus and went back to Forest Grove, Oregon, and went back to Pacific. And I graduated after 2 years, married the dean of women, got my son out here, and then I realized the day I got married, I got my real estate license. And I was showing a home in Gaston, and I was standing in front of the sink, and I fell through the floor, right up to my armpits. And I'm looking up at the people, and I said, you might not want to buy this place. It's a little rickety. I went back and told the boss. He laughed. Everybody in the office laughed. But that was the end of my real estate career. I realized that the city of Forest Grove did not have a good restaurant. So I went to OLCC, and Don Church was the administrator. And he said, Aldi, I cannot give you a license for liquor in Forest Grove until you get permission from the city council. So I ran for city council, and I was elected by 2 votes. And I left the room, and they voted on my liquor license, and I got it. So I built a coffee grinder restaurant, probably maybe 100, 150 seats with a big bar, and a beautiful place, and opened a restaurant. 482 employees because in the 5 years I had it, because I used college people, and they would work for one meal, want to get paid. It was terrible. So anyway, I went through a bunch of people, but I'd been a fireman for the city when I was at Pacific. I was a fireman for the city, and then I got on the city council, so I knew a lot of people in town, and they supported the restaurant, and I did quite well. Never made any money, but did quite well. I went to school with a guy that his father was in Oregon City. He had an antique shop called Castoffs and Cast-Iron. I can't remember the name. But anyway, he told me that Mrs. Richardson, who had a Holly Knoll Museum, was going to sell the museum. And they wanted $75,000 cash because the kids didn't want anything to do with the antiques. Mrs. Richardson had collected antiques all of her working career as a nurse. And her husband was in a rest home when she didn't leave him anything. So Walt said, he was the owner of the Cast Iron and Cast Off, said, we've got to take Mr. Richardson some money. So after the sale, we bought it for $75,000. We kept it until the following 4th of July weekend. We had 3 sessions a day for 5 days and sold all the antiques, 2,500 antiques. for the gross profit of probably $260,000, somewhere in there. So I paid everybody off that had loaned me money, and paid back the bank loan, and took all some of the antiques I put in my restaurant, which was really interesting because there were some beautiful things that she'd collected, including a back bar. And my Uncle Aldous, after whom I was named, willed me $1,000. And I bought the back bar in the drugstore for $1,000. And now my brother has it in South Carolina after it's coming up. Anyway, after that, I went back to Pacific and graduated, married the dean of women, got the real estate license, fell through the floor, got back, got the liquor license, and started the restaurant for 5 years. After that, I'd had enough. So I got out of the restaurant business, and I'd gone back to the Coast Guard and taken all of the tests after I got out of the Navy, and I was a qualified member of the engineering department. And I went to sea on a research vessel for Military Sea Lift Command out of Oakland, California. And the first year, I went from Adak, Alaska, to the Philippines on this research vessel. We'd go anywhere that the scientists wanted to go and do anything that they wanted to do. So then I got off of that and I went back home. And meantime, my son was still there, but he went in the Navy, or he went in the Army to Camp Casey in Korea, and I went to see him. After I got off the ship, I had some money. They paid me very well as a second electrician. And then I went to see my son in Camp Casey, Korea, South Korea. And it was in winter, and I was remembered playing soccer in the snow with the kids. And there were buildings, all, you know, apartment buildings on four sides, and this pitch was right in the middle of this soccer field, was in the middle of all these buildings. And here were these little kids playing with a big American in the snow in December. And when I went to the market the next day, I could hear all of the chatter. I never knew what they were talking about, but they were talking about me. And an old man stepped out from somewhere, and I had a full beard, and he took his hands, I still feel it. And he said, "Nice." That's all he said. That was a wonderful memory. Anyway, the kids were great, and the ladies were all, you know, happy to have somebody play with the kids in the snow. So anyway, I saw my son, and he was in the Army, Camp Casey in Tongachun, South Korea. And I came back, and then what did I do? I think that was when I went, the 1974 Career Employment Training Act of 1974. And I went to the city of Tigard under that auspices, and as director of the, or assistant to the director, the city manager. And he was from St. Albans, Vermont. He was a Mormon guy. And all of the planning department resigned. One of the guys said, "I'm not working for any Mormon." And I thought, you know, this is crazy. But anyway, the whole department packed up and left. And there I was, the planning director. And I told the boss, I said, "Can I apply for this job?" He said, "You sure can. If you can bail out of this one, you can have the job." So for 7 years, I was a planning director in Tigard, Oregon. The city went from 7,500 to 23,000 people in that 7 year period. I went back to Portland State and got a master's degree in public administration and left when my friend from school went to Kodiak, Alaska as a deputy manager, and that manager quit and Bill Bivin became the manager. And he called me up at 2 o'clock one morning and he said, "Are you interested in a job in Kodiak, Alaska?" And I said, "Sure." I packed my stuff, went to Kodiak, Alaska. And then We hired a new chief. The chief, I can't remember his name, but anyway, he was a sergeant in Juneau, and we hired him. But he lived with me for a couple months until he could find a place. He had a wife and five kids coming up from Juneau. And we hired him. He came up, and when he got drunk, he would talk about these things. And so we were reminiscing. And I told Bivin, I said, you know, he was the city manager, Bill Bivin, nice guy. And I told him, I said, you know, we got a Jekyll and Hyde in the department. He's a nice guy. Everybody likes him, but he's dangerous. He's going to really have a problem. Sure enough, he had a problem. About, maybe 6 months later, he was drunk. He was driving on the wrong-hand side of the road, arrested by the only woman in the department with the secretary with no clothes on. And he packed up and left Kodiak. However, the city council, Bivin was down in Juneau trying to get money for the city, and I was in charge. And I got to the city council, I put out a memorandum, meet me at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, it's an emergency meeting, be there. Well, why? I said, I'm not gonna tell you. So anyway, we got the meeting, and they're all yelling and screaming, what's the going on? I told them the story. All right, so they said, we want to see him. So I called the department and Sergeant Culberson. I said, go over there and find him and bring him in here. The council wants to see him. And he came back and he said, he's gone. Ween Air Alaska, flight at 8 o'clock this morning, he's gone. And the council said, we want to see him. You can tell the community anything you want, but we want to see him back. I said, I'm not lying to these people, no way in hell. We have employed you all day, you're going to do it. I said, no, I'm not. Finally, they settled down. And I went out to the airport to get Bill Bivin, and he said, oh, by the way, Monday morning, you're the chief of police. I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, I suggest you don't drink. So I was the chief of police, 42 people in the department, and we had a jail. We picked up all the natives at night so they wouldn't freeze. Took them in jail, gave them breakfast in the morning, and set them out again. And that happened 365 days a year. They just didn't have any way of improving their lives. They were caught. There were four or five villages on the island. And they had school, but then they came in for high school into Kodiak. And some of them did very well, and others didn't do very well. But anyway, I was the chief of police, and there was a barracks there for the Alaska State Police. And the captain called me one morning, and he said, Aldi, I want you to come with me. There's an issue out in one of the islands and the villages. So I went out with him. He shot her first, and then he shot himself, 16-year-olds. They're laying in the snow, dead. He said, Aldi, I want you to tell the parents, because I've done this before. And they were so stoic, they didn't even blink. I told them as easy as I could that their kids had been shot, and they were gone. But they never flinched. Anyway, I got out of Kodiak, and went back to Tigard. I rented my house to two women that I knew, and I went back to Tigard. And then my brother bought a winery in New Hampshire. Here's the wine story. He was making a rock maple-based liqueur, a maple syrup-based liqueur, and he made it for friends. You know, he was doing four or five fifths for Christmas and this New Year's and stuff. And he took a bottle to the state of New Hampshire, and they said, we'd like 500 cases. So he went from bottles to 500 cases. Jenkins Spirits made it for us, but I ran the winery. We'd inherited about 25,000 gallons of wine and about 10,000 gallons of apple wine vinegar. John Canepa had been a pharmacist in New Rochelle, New York, and he bought this 50 acres in New Hampshire and put in a vineyard and started the winery. And he competed with Annie Greensprings for apple wine for a number of years and left all this wine in casks. And then I knew Bernie from my experience here in Oregon with Chuck Khoury. And I called Bernie and he came out and we stabilized the wine and I ran the winery for 4 or 5 years. I hadn't been home for a while and it was good to see my parents again and my brothers. The three of us ran the winery. But we made switchel with the apple wine vinegar. And switchel was a beverage, apple wine vinegar, water, molasses, honey, and maple syrup. I made that in the lab. And I gave the tours through the winery, let the kids do the bottling and whatever that we had going. And I told them about switchel and the history of it. It was a military or navy that had used it, and the acid in the apples kept them from getting scurvy. So it was a very well-known beverage. In fact, lots of people after that came to the winery and told me about their experiences with switchel in the hay fields and how they survived and what switchel meant and on and on. And we were just a tourist attraction on the lake, on the shores of Lake Winnipesaukee in Belmont, New Hampshire. And the buses would arrive, everybody jump off the bus, smoke, drink all he could, get back on the bus and wouldn't buy a bottle. So I sent a bottle of switchel. We got a Yankee magazine showed up, and three guys in a winery in New Hampshire. It was the only winery in New Hampshire. It was the first winery in New England, then the only one in New Hampshire. And so Yankee magazine did an article on us. They would not advertise liquor, but I boiled all the alcohol off of the switchel, so they did an article on switchel. And after that, we sold it throughout America. And one lady sent it back. She said, "One lady, I don't like it." And she had a little bit they tasted in the bottle. I put that in a case in the winery, and I sold more switchel because people would read this letter and say, "I want some of that stuff the lady in Alabama didn't like." And I sold a lot of switchel, and I sold a lot of wine. We bottled it all up. We had a bottler, an old one, did most of it by hand, a filler, but the vineyard froze. And I tried to prune it, but it didn't do any good. So there were a few people that had invested in the winery, and so they were growing grapes. Maréchal Foch, which was a red, hardy, tough to deal with grape. Yeah, I think if you kept it in the bottle for 20 years, it might have been drinkable. But then I made some fruit wine. I made a beautiful wine from raspberries. A guy brought me 80 pounds of raspberries, and I fermented it and bottled it. Beautiful wine. I didn't give people a taste of that wine either. I wish I'd made 500 cases because everybody liked it, and I sold out all that wine. Anyway, I'm digressing a little bit, but that was my first avenue into the winery. But in the getting back to Forest Grove, I met Charles Khoury when I had the restaurant, and he was on Main Street. I can still see him walking down the street, and I knew who he was because of everybody. You should meet Charles Khoury. So I went across the street and I introduced myself. And I was at his first crush. He'd lined a trough into the basement, into the totes, with tin foil. And we crushed the grapes, and they went down into the basement. His father was alive at that time, Pops Khoury, a nice guy. And his wife was there, and the two boys, Charlie and Brad. Brad later went on to Seattle And Charlie went down to Eugene. But anyway, I just worked for Chuck as a friend. You know, he never paid me. I just learned from him all I could. But he decided to expand, so he went from a small home brand winery, and he bought grapes from Washington. And he didn't really wash them off properly, and so when he crushed them, here were the vats, just sort of brown, green, blue, purple. And there was a Rubillon Gaillon. He was from France. He was somebody hired him to come and research the winery, Oregon winery, wine industry. And he went by these totes and he looked over and I was right behind him. And he said to Chuck, "Monsieur, this will not be your finest vintage." And I got laughing so hard, Chuck kicked my ass out of the winery and we went back. I was in the leaves laughing. Anyway, that was, it was true. It was not his finest vintage. And anyway, I made a sign for Chuck, BBE, bad but extraordinaire, and I hung it in his office when he was gone one day. And he would sit behind his office, in his chair, behind the desk, and he finally got to about $250,000 in accounts payable. And he looked around and he couldn't pay it. But he'd given a class in wine appreciation at Portland State. And the Tepler brothers, Mark and David Tepler, showed up. And they eventually bought the winery from Chuck. And that was sort of a sad situation because Chuck didn't realize that they had put in this money, paid all his bills, and he continued to think that he was in charge. And they told him quite frankly he was not, and he left. They paid him some money and he left. And he went into Portland and he started a brewery making wine or making beer. He got the recipes from the Portland Public Library and started making beer. Some of it was good and some of it came out of a horse. But he persisted, and then he didn't pay taxes. I loaned him the money to pay his taxes for the Washington, for Multnomah County taxes. He didn't pay them, and Multnomah locked the building and sold everything he had at an auction. And that really busted him. He went down to California, Calistoga, and moved into his father's house. His father's passed away, and that's where he was. So when I was sailing, after the winery in New Hampshire, I went back to sailing as a second electrician. And when we'd come back, the office was in Oakland. And when we'd come back from sailing, I'd go up to Calistoga and see him. And he worked around for a couple wineries and His attitude wasn't really in it. You know, he'd been broken. And we had a good time together, though. I tell you, he was a good man to party with. He had a story to tell, and so did I. You know, I was just a sailor. There's something about a sailor that you don't understand unless you go to sea. You come into port a whole different way. You can drive in, you can fly in, and then you can bring a ship in. And it's altogether different. And so, yeah, I did 18 years at sea, been around the world 4.5 times. And I wanted to see the world before some idiot blew it up. And I was in Desert Storm, sure as hell. I was on a tanker, 188,000 barrels of oil under my butt, in the middle of the Persian Gulf during the war. Not a good place to be. Anyway, after that, I came back. I got crushed on a survey or a supply ship in Subic Bay with two forklifts came together and busted my tip. And when I got better, I went back to Oakland I met this lady and who had a couple of children. I later married her in the Philippines and adopted the kids. And we came to America, but when I was injured, I went back to Oakland and I got fixed up, patched up, and they made me a purser, administrative officer. So I went from the bilge to third in command of the ship. Unbelievable, you know, it was the captain, the repair officer, and me, the purser, in charge of these huge, 100 feet across, 266, 366, 566 feet long, huge ships. Then we come along and we were the resupply for the battle group. There was a carrier and a couple of destroyers and an escort and a submarine lurking around. And we'd pump oil to them. We could pump diesel, JP5, water, anything they needed. And one day I went across in a Jacob's chair and they dunked me in the water between. They'd shoot a line across and then the chair would go across and then you'd sit in this little chair and the bosun slacked the line and I went into the drink. Then everybody laughed. And I went onto the aircraft carrier and I met a guy who had been on the ship for R&R when we went into port. We usually go to Jebel Ali in the Persian Gulf, which is a big man-made port, and pick up our oil and then sail out. Anyway, I got to fire a jet right off the carrier deck. That was fun. I went back aboard the ship. Everybody, they didn't dunk me that time when I went back. Anyway, I got out of that 18 years, went back to Forest Grove, settled down, and I started to be a land use consultant. And while I was in Forest Grove, before I should tell you that I knew Dick Erath. I worked for him two crushes. Yeah, he was a good guy. I knew his son. I knew his wife, first wife. And I worked for him. I worked for the Redford, Myron Redford, and his brother, Steve. The first crush, they had a carjack on top of the press. I can still see Steve pulling that and press the grapes in this with a carjack. We went down a couple of days and picked grapes for Myron. He's in Hawaii, I just spoke to him last week. Anyway, then I went back and I had my consulting business. And I still had an interest in winery. My wife had a wine club out of Portland. You know, wine group. I knew a lot of the people in the wine industry. And then I met a guy named Peter Cummings. Peter Cummings had done very well in the toy business, making toys. He started out making boomerangs in Australia. He's an Australian boy. Then he made some product in Forest Grove at the old armory. And I took them dinners. They work all night, and then I take them dinner at night so they could work. And he helped me with a toy that I had from the Holly Noah Museum sale, Mrs. Richardson's sale. I was cleaning up, and this toy fell down behind a bookcase. It was a little toy about this with numbers, and you could take 2 feet and put one on four and one on eight, and 32 would show up between the monkey's hands. It was patented in 1917, and again in, they did two patents, 11 and 17. But the patent had run out, actually, so I made it and pressed off a bunch and sold them. And Peter Cummings helped me with that toy, and we sold them all over the world. He did very well. He's now in Hong Kong, but he owns 200 acres in Banks, Oregon. And he hired me as a consultant recently, last year, to do a winery, a brewery, and a tasting room on that acreage. We're going to plant 15 acres of Chardonnay and 15 acres of Pinot Noir. And we bought the plants from Joel Meyer, an old friend of mine. He came back around. And we're going to plant the vineyard. And Peter was in hemp, lost his butt in hemp. But he irrigated all his fields on this acreage. He has two beautiful big ponds. He has a water right to one of them, we can irrigate. And so he wants to be in the wine business. He went back to Hong Kong, had both hips replaced, and went into China, where his company is. And right after the, maybe two or three days after the operation, then he really screwed his legs up. So he came back, and they eventually, after three operations, he got two standard hip replacements. And then he got an infection, and he just got over it. He told me yesterday he was fine. So he's coming back in April, and then he's gonna go back to Hong Kong, and then he's gonna back for the summer. And we'll plant the vineyard in September, October, and maybe with irrigation we can get a crop after two or three years. And so that's the story of my wine industry. It came all the way around, a big circle, around. I knew just enough to get in trouble in Oregon, in New Hampshire, and I did. I made wine that was, some of it was beautiful, and others put it in the drain. But anyway, I knew a lot of people in the wine industry. I still do. Myron's, I say, is in Hawaii. I called him the other day, talked to him. And Dick Erath just passed away, Ponzi's, David Adelsheim. All these guys, I either knew them or worked for them. I was just labor, you know. I made a little wine when I got to Belmont, but some of it was good and some of it was bad. So that's my story. I'm still in Forest Grove as a land use consultant, and I've enjoyed my life 100%. If I die tomorrow, remember, I had a hell of a life and I'm still living. I'm gonna be 85 in March. Yeah, we're gonna go to Florida to celebrate it with my brothers. Yeah, that's my life.
You mentioned you knew Barney Watson as well.
Yeah.
So tell me about, after you started working with Charles Corey, how did you learn winemaking? What was the process like for you to become proficient enough to make wine in New Hampshire?
I was fairly intelligent, and I talked to these guys and I watched them. Dick Erath was the one that showed me most of what I knew. I remember he put too much yeast in a big tank, and it just erupted. Purple flame just shot out of the top of this tank, and he said, "I think I used too much yeast." Well, he did. Because it was just an eruption, like a volcano out of the tank. But he showed me a lot of stuff. And my brother, Peter, was a science teacher, and he knew about chemistry. So when we got into Belmont, he would help me with the chemical situation. You know, how much to do, how much of this, and heat the yeast, pour it in. And quantities and milliliters and all that stuff. So I learned, and I was never a very good winemaker. The best wine I ever had was that raspberry wine. It came out perfect. But that's how I learned. I learned from all the guys. Myron and his brothers went down there to pick grapes. We earned a little bit there. Chuck taught me a little bit. Although his vintage was not the best, that was funny. Anyway, Chuck was a good guy, and he got involved in a ozone generator in Calistoga, and Carlson and Associates made a very nice unit. And I asked him if I could be the distributor in Oregon, and they said sure. So I took these ozone generators around, sold one in Eugene to King Estates, sold one to a guy in Hood River that was making orange juice, sold another one to the guy in Banks that was making honey. That, you know, he was shipping it to California, 50-gallon drums. But this system was so clean. It was a cold system. It had a venturi that put the ozone into the water, and then you sprayed it around. but it would kill all of the bacteria. Put it in a 50-gallon drum, it'd kill all the bacteria. And then they had a test kit. One guy developed it. The material was from a firefly enzyme. And you stick this swab into whatever you were cleaning, then if there was any residual life left, it'd show up. But if you'd cleaned it, it was negative. And I showed it to David Tepla up there at the winery, on Curie's Winery. He couldn't believe it. I showed it to this guy in honey guy. One of his tanks, he put the honey in 55-gallon drums and send it down to California. If there was anything in there, it would rotten, make the honey go bad. And I showed him this system. I swabbed the barrel. He said, "Leave that machine right here. I'm buying it." He wrote me a check for $15,000. And I called down to Calistoga. "I need another machine. I just sold it." He couldn't believe it. But anyway, I went to a few wineries that way and showed them. But the small guys couldn't afford $15,000 for a ozone generator. So I got together with a guy in Newburg that was making apple cider, and he used the generator. He kept it and used it, and his cider improved 100%, and he was number one in the state fair with cider that year. Yeah, it was a real system, I'm telling you, and lots of people use them now. There's a winery in Carlton. It's the Carlton Wine Studio. And they have an ozone generator right there, and I asked the kid that was there when we went through the place. I said, "Do you use that generator?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "It's from Carlson. Do you know that company?" He said, "No." I said, "I work for them." So they're still using them. Some people think that it would change the flavor in the wines. It never did. It turned to, the ozone dissipated after it's done its job and went back to atmospheric. So that's it. I keep remembering all these stories.
Yeah.
It's just my life.
So tell me a little bit about Charles Curie.
Charles Curie, he was an irascible son of a bitch. Unless you treated him with respect and realized that he was intelligent, and then he got along fine. I remember once in the vineyard, he was shooting robins with a shotgun, and he gave me the shotgun, and he had one and I had one, bird shot in it, and he was trying to hit the robins, he missed it. And I said, "It's real easy, Chuck, you just shoot him." And I pulled the trigger and a robin fell right at my feet. He said, "Son of a bitch," he said, "I've been trying to hit a robin for 2 days, how did you do that?" And I told him, "You gotta lead them when they lead," and like this. And then he shucked a bunch of them and made a robin stew, and his wife threw it out. He was mortified. Anyway, later, when I had the restaurant, he came to work for me as a bartender. And my brother still remembers Chuck because he taught Raj how to make some Ramos Fizz or something like that. And he worked for me for a while as a bartender. So I had, and as I say, then when he went to Calistoga, I went to see him quite often. And we would go out drinking. Yeah, shit. He had a bicycle he ran into the woods with. We had a good time. He was a good guy. His Charlie, you interviewed Charlie. I asked you. You said you'd interviewed him. Brad, I don't think Brad's alive. He went up to Seattle, and Charlie went to Eugene. I've never seen him before or again after he left. I dated what was her name? She had a connection to the wine industry. Oh, Chuck Curie's brother or something. Yeah, Chuck Curie's brother dated Betts Curie. And I dated her for a while. And that's how I met Charlie and all the rest of them, and that Cal, ERS boy. I think Scal's still around. He had a restaurant in Hillsboro once. He had a restaurant here in Newburgh.
Well, you mentioned. Well, let's talk about Barney Watson a little bit, because you mentioned Barney actually came back with you to New Hampshire. So tell me how that came to be.
Well, I met him when he lived in Corvallis, and I met him somewhere in this wine industry. You know, he saved a lot of guys in the wine industry because he was an enologist and a viticulturist, and he'd worked as a cellar rat, and so he knew a lot of these people and he knew their problems. And this was a brand new industry. You know, I never even had Oregon wine in my restaurant in 1970 because nobody knew about it until 72, and somebody went to France and got medal or something, and finally people realized that the Oregon Pinot Noir was good, and so that started the whole industry. But Barney helped a lot of people, and I knew him, went down to Corvallis often. He had some wine in a big barrel out and back. He married Nola. I think they had two boys, and then I asked him, you know, if he would come back and help me in the winery, and he said sure. So he came back and helped me. But I thought it was going to lead to him staying, and that didn't work out. So I got a little angry at him and wrote him a nasty letter. I don't think he ever forgot me or forgave me. But that's how I knew him. A lot of times we went to Corvallis, and Barney was a good guy. I'd like to meet him again, see him again. I called him. I got his number from Marwin and called him up, but I haven't heard from him. He's probably still smarting from the letter I wrote to him so many years ago. Anyway, good guy. He went to Chemeketa Junior College and taught enology and viticulture there. Smart boy. And as I say, he saved a lot of people's ass because they didn't know what they were doing. Malolactic fermentation, what's that? And Barney knew, and he told him. And anyway, I'd like to see him again. Maybe I will. Who else you want to know about? Dick Erath, he passed away. He was an awful good guy. He taught me a lot. And I never did get to play a game of cribbage with him. He was an avid cribbage player. But I knew him for a long time. He just passed away. I saw him at the vineyard quite often. You know, I lived in Forest Grove, and I'd come down to Dundee Hills, and there he was. And we had a good time together. I worked for him during the two crushes, probably, and learned a lot from him. He was easy going. He was a real nice guy, easy going, laughing, big smile, and I liked him. He liked me. Who else you want to know about?
Well, who else did you interact with? I mean, you mentioned the Redfords.
Yeah, Myron Redford and his brother Steve. I picked grapes for him. I went down there several times over the years. He had a mobile home on the acreage, and he had a nice little tasting room. We'd go down there and drink a little bit. He'd show me how he did it, what he did, how he did it. So I learned a little bit from Myron. And there was another guy too, Bill Fuller. Mm-hmm. Bill Fuller started Tualatin Vineyards later, bought him out. Well, Amit Vineyard bought him out, yeah. But he had a big vineyard. I just went up there the other day. It's still there. The lady that runs the tasting room graduated from Forest Grove High School with one of the girls that I adopted, came to America. She was pregnant, had a daughter named Helen, H-E-L-Y-N, after my mother. She just had her third child. She's married up in Tacoma to a guy in the Army. And She graduated with the lady that's running the tasting room for Willamette Vineyards. Yeah, small world, I'm telling you. There was a guy at, we were up at the Eminent Domain, big winery. We drove up, you had to go there by appointment, but here's the guy, the owner, Jeff something or other.
Jeff
Meter. Yeah, okay, he's standing in the yard with a glass of wine. We drive up, and there's a big cat. And this, he has, I have a cat named Gracie, and he had a big cat. I don't know what the name of it, but a big, big animal. And we got to talking with him, and he said, come in. So we went into the tasting room, and he bought a bottle of wine, for my love. And he got talking around how we were going to do it. One of the things about David Peter Cummings is that I would never have suggested that he do a winery unless, and in fact, he had a guy in China with a connection. And that guy, his name is Wang, and he is a world-renowned, he was educated in Paris, he's a world-renowned expert on wines. I met him at a party that, that Peter had, and he's coming back in April, and he's going to buy all the wine that we can make. And that's the only reason that I suggested to Peter Cummings that he get into the wine business, because there are 1,000 wineries in the state. Yeah, really, there's so much. Anyway, Wang's going to show up. He's a nice guy. He'll take everything we can make. So Peter, in the hemp business, lost his butt. But he built a huge building in North Plains, 35,000 square foot warehouse to extract hemp. And then when the thing all went to hell, he still had the building. So it's in rural residential zoning, so we can buy grapes from Washington, Oregon, anywhere, and press the grapes and have the winery there. And he's going to bring all the equipment from Kentucky, California, Canada, and Colorado. In fact, one of the boys is in Colorado right now getting the equipment. We'll need the tanks, the stainless steel piping, and everything we need, the heaters, the coolers, and we're going to assemble a winery in North Plains. And we can have a tasting room and do it right. And Peter's done very well in the toy business. I mean, very well. So he can afford to do whatever he needs to do to get that thing up and running. Then I'll be back in the wine business. Round and round and round it goes. Where it stopped, nobody knows. But anyway, that's my story.
What were your impressions of Oregon wine in the 1970s, 1980s? What was the wine like? What were the people like?
Nobody knew what it was like. And they made small batches. They experimented. You know, Chuck planted Pinot, and he planted Gewurztraminer, and a couple other varieties that you could make wine. That was one thing about Barney. He went around every vineyard in this state and made a little wine from each of the wineries. And he had it down there in Corvallis, in jugs. I remember that. Little bubblers on the top of this stuff, fermenting. But anyway, the people were genuine. The wine, nobody knew about the Oregon wine. You know, that's why I didn't have it in my restaurant. It was surrounded by wineries. Montanore, David Lett down here, and
Irie,
yeah, all these guys, they were making wine, but I just didn't understand how important it was to the wine industry that became a multi-billion dollar industry in this state. Nobody did. We were doing Albaden, and there was a company down in Honeywood in Salem that was making fortified wine for the drunks in Portland. He says, you know, that was all fruit and berry wines. And nobody really understood what we're doing. But Chuck Curry did, and so did Ponzi, and so did a couple other guys. Lett, he knew what was coming. And they all had enough foresight. You know, Chuck Curry and Dick Erath wrote the OLCC and wrote the requirements for a winery. It just didn't exist. They didn't know what a winery was. Then they had licensed Honeywood, but you know, it was brand new industry, and nobody really envisioned what Chuck and these pioneers had envisioned. And so, yeah, later, I would have had Oregon wine in my restaurant, but in 1970, 75, no. Almaden, Rio Nitti, and all that stuff. Goat piss, you know. But anyway, that's what happened, and now it's a huge industry.
How much attention have you paid to the growth?
Well, as much as possible, you know. I always looked, whenever we went to Florida, we had a home in Florida, I'd go to the wine shops and ask about Oregon wines, and they'd look at me like, oh, we got a couple bottles over here somewhere. What do you want? How kind of, yeah. So, yeah, the only way that they got the wine out was the event in France, 1972 or something, that it just knocked the socks off their wines. And then people gradually got into it, you know, they started drinking it. There were wine clubs and that kind of thing. And now, you know, Erath was the only vineyard in Dundee. And now you drive through the Dundee Hills and there are hundreds of wineries in that place. So I had a wine festival once in Forest Grove in the gymnasium. Got a bunch of wine guys to come in. Yeah, had a good time. Didn't make any money, but had a good time. Yeah. Yeah. When you called me up, when I called the lady at Wine Press, and she mentioned you, and we got together, I started thinking about all this stuff, you know, like how I involved and how the thing and where I was. And you forced me to do a lot of thinking, which is probably a good thing. And my memory is not quite what it was, but I remember a lot.
So what are some of your favorite memories, wine-related memories in Oregon?
Oh, Chuck Curry shooting the robins and trying to make a robin pie. Jesus, that was crazy. And then down in Calistoga, we had great times. Dick Erath, you know, working with him, he knew what he was doing. Myron Redford and Steve, those guys, I remember them all. Yeah, my wife thinks I should have had a winery. Well, I know I should have, but shoulda, woulda, coulda, didn't, you know?
Sounds like you're about to.
Well, now I will, yeah. With Peter Cummings, I've suggested, he's got two beautiful ponds in this thing, you know, duck ponds down here. And I told him, there were beautiful geese. I said, how about two geese and two ducks for a winery logo? He looked at me, he said, you're nuts. I said, how about that? You're nuts winery. He just laughed anyway.
Yeah. That's good. Appreciate all your time,
your
stories.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing with us.
I don't know anybody else that has the stories I have.
I can't even imagine anybody else could have the stories you have. So go ahead and let you off the hook. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Oregon Wine History Archive podcast. And thank you to all our supporters, partners, donors, and interviewees who have helped make our project a success. Be sure to check out our website at OregonWineHistoryArchive.org for more interviews, photographs, wine labels, and more. And stay tuned for more interviews as we tell the story of Oregon wine. The Oregon Wine History Archive podcast is brought to you from the Oregon Wine History Archive at Linfield University, with a very special thank you to all the Linfield Archive students who have contributed to these oral history interviews over the years.